So this is the last week in our sermon series called Be the Change. It's the end of this series that we've been doing on relationships, and this is a wrap-up week. It's a time where you may not learn a lot of new things, but it's a time to sort of pull it all together as we talk about the difficulty and the challenge in being in relationship with people. I hope this series has been hard for you. I hope it has pushed you. I hope it has made you think about your relationships with other people and the motivations behind the things that we say and the ways that we interact with one another. I think one of the most potent things that came out of it for me was this idea of, do I spend more time deconstructing people's arguments than constructing relationships with other people? Am I more about trying to beat down someone who I disagree with than I am about caring whether or not they are a person? And I think we've done a good job in this series of identifying some of the motivations behind things and the words that we say, but I don't know that anywhere in this series we have really dealt with the so what. Why does it matter? I mean, ultimately, if you lose a friendship, is it really that big of a deal? Why is it important? What happens if we walk away and do nothing? What's lost if we don't do the hard work of trying to build relationships and be in relationship with people? We've been having some conversations at Restoration about all the things we do. And we've been trying to say, if we stopped doing some of the things that we do, what would be lost? Like if we stopped serving at the shelter, what would be lost for that? If we stopped making meals for kids, what would happen? And we've been answering this so what question a lot. So what? Why do we do it? We do it so that X happens, so that lives are transformed. So it hit me this week that maybe we need to address this so what question in this conversation. So what? What if we don't just quit? What if we actually deal with these relationships? Or maybe we look at it the other way. So what if we lose relationships? What if we fight so much and we break down conversations that people are no longer in our lives? Isn't life easier just to do it alone when we don't have to deal with or interact with other people? Because really, I rarely disagree with myself. Most of the time, I like me. Now, these might sound ridiculous to you because you say, well, relationships are important, Tim. Of course, we're going to deal with them. But I wonder if you think back to the last 6 months of your life. Think about some of the conversations that you've had that have been heated. Disagreements that you've had with other people. And maybe you're unlike me. Maybe you haven't had any. But I wonder if you think back to those places in your life, have you revealed through your actions that you actually do care about relationships? Or are you finding yourself more in a place where you care more about being right? I think I'm the latter often. So we've been in this sermon that Jesus gave called the Sermon on the Mount, trying to figure this out. And in the Sermon on the Mount, often known as the best sermon that's ever been given, Jesus turns all this stuff upside down. All these things that the culture thinks are right, all these things that the culture values, and Jesus flips them upside down. And this week we're going to look at the last part of this sermon, where in just one verse he drops a really powerful word. He says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." Blessed are those who long for righteousness. I love the words that Jesus used here, hunger and thirst. Have you ever been hungry? Y'all got to wake up this morning. Have you ever been hungry? You're like, I don't know. It's only 10:30. I had breakfast a little while ago. I had snacks when I came. Have you been hungry? Like, do you know what it's like to really be hungry? Right? Have you been really thirsty? Have you been on a run? Have you done any exercise? And you come back and you're like, wow, I am really thirsty. Those are very visceral things, right? They're transformative things. If we have someone in our family who's really hungry, they may not be pleasant to be around. If we have someone who's really thirsty, that might be hard. It causes us to pause. And Jesus uses these words, you should hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now we might say that's a word we don't actually use in our culture very much today, righteousness. What does that mean? We might use the word righteous. That has a very negative connotation, right? If someone's more holy or righteous than others. And I think part of our problem with righteousness is we've been confusing it a lot in our culture today with its cousin that actually doesn't look like it at all, which is rightness. Right? The act of being right. So many conversations I see happening, whether they're in person or on social media or I overhear, are all about being right. I want to end the conversation by being right, not what Jesus says, which is righteous. See, righteousness, which is not like being right, is about being completely connected and reconciled to God. Being completely connected and reconciled to other people. So you see where rightness becomes a problem with righteousness, right? Because if I'm all worried about being right, I'm not about worried about being reconciled with other people. If I'm worried about always having the right answer or my opinion being the right thing, righteousness is not my goal. I think one of the challenges that we have with the word righteous is that we think we link it completely to perfection, right? If someone is righteous, if they're righteous with God, then they must be perfect. And actually, perfect is not a word that we love in our culture, right? Perfect is a hard word. I was thinking this week, we are in the throes of our oldest. He is in sixth grade. And he is in this place where he's starting to make decisions about classes that he takes that will affect middle school, that will affect high school, that will affect college, and whether or not he ever gets a job, right? He's a sixth grader, right? We are in this place. Our child must figure out perfection. He's got to figure it out. So I was looking, not for this, I promise. I was looking for an illustration this week, and I was looking at Stanford. Not for our 11-year-old, trust me. But I was looking at Stanford, and I was looking at what it requires. What's the requirement to get into Stanford right now? Stanford takes 5% of people who apply there. So I think they had 42,000 people that applied last year, and they took like 2,000 people. 42,000 people applied. On their website, it says that if you get a 33 on the ACT, you are in the top 50% of people who get there. Do you know what a perfect score on the ACT is? A 35. If you get a 33, you're in the top 50%. Now, only 5% of that top 50% get in, and the average score is a 34 or 35 for students who get in. The average GPA for a student who goes to Stanford is 4.18 on a 4.0 scale. Do the math and figure that out, friends. The average SAT score is like a 1560 out of 1600. And you need all the extracurriculars and all that jazz. In fact, on Stanford's website, they say something to the effect of you basically should try to be perfect if you want to get in here. And somehow, 40,000 imperfect people apply every year. 40,000 imperfect people apply. And oh, by the way, it's about $60,000 per year in tuition to go there. Paying to get in and be perfect. I think one of the turnoffs that people have about the church today is they think, the perception is that the people who are on the inside think they're perfect. Do you see the difference there? Not that the people on the inside actually are perfect. But the perception is that I think people view people on the inside of the church and think, oh, they think they're perfect. They think they don't have any problems. But remember, even if we confuse perfection and righteousness, perfection and righteousness are actually not what Jesus calls us to. What does he call us to in that passage? He calls us to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Do you see the distinction right there? He calls us to want it, to want to be reconciled with other people, to want to be reconciled with God. In fact, I don't even think want is the right word. When I'm hungry, it's not just that I want something to eat. When I'm really hungry, I have to have it. And in this passage at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus is saying is, you have to have righteousness. You long for it. You want it with every ounce of your being. But how do we get there? What does it look like when it comes to relationships? What does being reconciled to other people look like? I'm going to go a little bit further, just a little bit past this, still in the book of Matthew, just past this part called the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount. And I want to read you 6 verses from chapter 5. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.' But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raka,' is answerable to the court." Or as Jesus translates, "Anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell." If you call somebody a fool. "Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in the front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you're still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out of jail until you have paid the last penny." I think it's interesting how Jesus opens this. He opens it giving them the law, right? He says, "You've heard it said that if you kill people, that's bad." Right? And nobody can disagree with that, right? Like, nobody can go, "Oh, here's Jesus again." Right? Nobody can say that killing people, I mean, I would almost guarantee, I can't guarantee anything with 100%, that most people in this room would agree with that statement. Killing people should have punishment. I mean, Jesus begins and he names that. You're going to be judged if you do that. So he names this and then he says, most of you are never going to kill people in your life, so stop using that as the gold standard. Stop using that as I'm better than other people because at least I don't kill people. I mean, if that's your minimum, y'all. I mean, think about our culture today. Does that not sometimes seem like the minimum anymore? Well, as long as we're not killing each other, we'll duke it out and see how far it goes. But don't kill people. Jesus goes on and he says, if you're angry with your brother or sister, then you're subject to judgment. Can you imagine the people who were listening to this part of the sermon? Jesus gets up and he says, you've heard it said that if you kill your brother or sister, da-da-da-da-da-da. And these people are like, I'm good. Right? I've got it all going on. I haven't killed anybody. You haven't killed anybody. Let's go to lunch. Right? We're not going to deal with the next part of what Jesus says because I'm sure it's going to be great because we haven't killed anybody. We can stop listening. And they're so, so excited until Jesus drops this thing where he says, oh, and by the way, don't be angry with anyone. I can imagine the chatter stopping right then. The chatter of we've got this all together. Because it was a problem in the first century just like it's a problem today. Jesus says, don't let your arguments control you. And this is so important to Jesus that he says, don't even come to the table. The table that Jesus opens to all people. He says, don't come to the altar if you got an anger with a friend. Don't come if there is something that is keeping you away. Now, I don't think it's that Jesus doesn't want people to come to the temple. I don't think it's that Jesus thinks, oh, well, you know, you're not good enough. I think Jesus believes it is so important that we are reconciled with one another that he will even put that on the line. Don't come to the table if you haven't figured it out. My Tuesday evening life group this week was talking about this intersection of faith and life. And how do we actually live out our faith in the reality of our everyday life? Like, what does that look like? Especially if we don't want to be people who are, you know, standing at the front of the office going, do you know Jesus? Do you know Jesus? Like, how do we do this? And ultimately, we spent like 30 minutes talking about this, and we had all these ideas, and people were saying, oh, we could do X, we could do Y, we could do X, until this one guy who's in our group who's pretty quiet, he said, I mean, shouldn't we just love people? Like, isn't that the thing? And he throws that out, and as simple as that sounds, I wonder how transformative that would be when it comes to righteousness in our lives. What if we chose to love someone more than our point? What if we chose to love someone more than being right? What if we chose to care about the people who God so deeply cares about? Y'all, it seems to me that Jesus takes this whole concept very seriously. I mean, he says, if you call your brother or sister a fool, you will be in danger of spending eternity in hell. Right? Do you know Jesus does not say that stuff often? He doesn't just throw that out as a possibility. It's not like parenting often is. Well, if you don't do that, you're never going to play on your Xbox again, right? That's parenting. Not good parenting, but it's parenting. But Jesus doesn't do that. And I don't think what Jesus is saying here, and if you're sitting here this morning and you're going, crap, I called somebody a fool last week. I guess I'm going to hell. I don't think that's what Jesus means. I think what he's saying is if we are people who care more about being right and who care more about putting people down and deconstructing people than constructing relationships, then the nature of our heart is one that will constantly be in a place of discouragement and pain. If that's our focus, Jesus doesn't say that I'm going to send you to hell. He says, realize if your life is mostly about judgment of others and not about preserving and building into relationships, it's likely that you're going to spend a life filled with judgment. You're going to spend your life filled with pain. Now, that might be too harsh for many of you, but I actually think about ultimate reconciliation with God, and I think it's more about the condition of our heart than about the actions every day that we do. I don't think it's a checkbox. I don't think it's a set of laws or rules. Friends, it's often easier to live by a list of rules and laws than it is to live in authentic, dynamic, real relationships. And I think that's what Jesus is calling us to. I read from a guy named Jesse Middendorf this week. He's a Nazarene pastor. And I read this on this passage that I thought was really interesting. He said, for instance, it's not enough to prohibit the killing of another. The point is the value of the other. What is required is that we not only fail to do them harm, but that we are engaged in proactively seeking their good, affirming their worth, even to the risk of our own good. And it begins with us. We dare not wait for them to act, to seek us out, to offer us a hand in reconciliation. We cannot even worship well until we have stepped redemptively toward another with whom we are in conflict. Y'all, that like hit me in the gut this week. It hit me in the gut. Like, I can't even do all this other stuff until I'm reconciled with people. And I have to care more about them than about my point of view. And that's hard, right? It's especially hard when we really disagree with people. And I'm not saying, please do not walk out of here and say, well, I guess I have to agree with everything so-and-so says. No, that's not Jesus' point. But we have to believe they have human value and worth. We have to believe they matter, and we have to love them. So what? Why does this whole thing matter? That's the question I asked in the beginning. It seems to me that this is actually a conversation about eternity. It's a conversation about others feeling valued and about our righteousness and our ultimate relationship with God, the depth of that relationship, the depth of that connection. So I ask you this morning, does being right trump being righteous? Because for me, I think I've lived a lot of the last year and a half or so allowing rightness to trump righteousness. And it seems like I've allowed that to be more important to me. I want to work on that in my own life. And there are a couple of things that I want to leave you with this morning. A couple of things that I think will be helpful. We've mentioned them already. None of these are new in this series. The first is humility. The beginning of the Beatitudes are all about being humble. That's why they turn everything on their heads. Do you realize that humility is actually not a natural thing for most of us? To be humble? Humility is not a natural thing. And the Beatitudes say, be humble. A different way of saying it is we can begin to be the change God longs to see in the world only when we recognize that we are part of the problem. One of the things in my house with my kids that I push so often. When someone comes to yell about somebody else, I say, hey, what did you do? How are you part of the problem? Because I think until we realize we're part of the problem, we certainly can't be part of the solution. We have to realize that we're part of the problem. So that first step is humility. And the second is this call of God on our lives to be different. That's what the Beatitudes are. They're all about being different. Jesus calls us to be different. Jesus said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. What we know from the end of this is that righteousness is not about, you guys can come on in and go ahead and sit with your parents, that's fine. Righteousness is not about being right on every issue. I mean, the right position on an issue is not to murder. If that's all that we're worried about being right, then we have a problem, friends. We shouldn't simply avoid the end of hate, the destruction of others. We should actually avoid the very beginning of hate, the very beginning of anger, the very beginning of being against others. Righteousness is about being reconciled, friends. It's about being reconciled with others, about connecting with them. I was thinking this week what I long for in the church. You know, the United Methodist Church is in a bit of a tenuous position trying to figure out who it is. I long for the church to be a place where people feel valued. I long for the church to be the change in the world, not because the church has this perception of being perfect, but I long for the church to seek out loving others so much that righteousness is the longing that we have in our hearts, not rightness. See, I think the church can fall in the same place. The church can find itself in a place where we forget about righteousness and we worry so much about rightness and being right. Here's what I promise us. If we love people enough that we have relationships with them, we'll begin to care less about always having the upper hand, and we'll begin to care more about the people whom God deeply loves. And that, friends, that changes the world. That delights the heart of God.